thanks for downloading this podcast from RNIB Connect Radio. On RNIB Connect Radio.
Natalie Cole. And this will be an everlasting love. You're listening to The Happy Hour on RNIB Connect Radio. Paulina here, as always, chatting all things happiness, well-being, and different ways that we can look after our minds and our bodies. Which brings me to some of the really interesting conversations we'll have on the show today. We'll be chatting with Paralympic VI skier Mena Fitzpatrick. We'll also be speaking with Deborah Rosen about her passion for music, about playing the violin, about singing, and also some of the barriers she has come across the years and how she overcame them. And we'll also have, of course, great music with one of my favorites from the Rembrandts. I can tease that one. And you probably know which track it is if you're a fan of that particular American sitcom. We'll also have a really interesting conversation with Kat, who will share how her story of sight loss and also how she has overcome an eating disorder. So we'll be hearing about that a bit later in the show. And I'll also give you some interesting facts about happiness. Apparently, you can now teach happiness in school to kids. Well, all of that and more coming up on the Happy Hour. For now, some music with Paloma Faith. You're listening to The Happy Hour on RNIB Connect Radio. Deborah Rosen is a musician. She plays in an orchestra and also shares her love for music through videos online. Well, her passion, unfortunately, was not always met without challenges. And she joins me now to share a little bit of her story with us. It's so nice to have you on the show today, Deborah.
Thank you so much for having me.
You studied classical music, if I'm correct, from a very, very young age. I think, was it 3 years old when you started?
Yes, I was about 3 and a half when I decided I wanted to play my grandfather's violin, which was far too big for me. So I got to start with a little tiny quarter-sized violin, which seems an extremely long time ago now. But I think it was just one of those things for me that music was always in my heart, and particularly the violin.
And you have progressed from violin to actually playing an orchestra, I think at the age of 6. And then you actually studied music as well in school for quite a long part of your life.
Well, when I was 6 years old, actually, I remember quite distinctly, it was quite an interesting experience, because when you first join an orchestra, there's a lot of discipline that they expect of you, which is quite difficult when you're 6. And you really do have to focus in a completely different way, focusing on all the other musicians you're working with, a conductor for the first time. And I remembered thinking it was so overwhelming and I'd never be good enough to join the orchestra. But actually, as you go along and as you learn, you realize you're really capable of developing those sorts of skills. So even when you're young, I think it's important to just bear in mind the fact that there's a lot of improvement to come and a lot of things do get a lot easier as you go. I think generally my attitude to learning is very much one of saying, I don't know this yet, but if I keep working at it and keep trying at things, I know that at least I'm going to get better. And so that's sort of my ethos, really.
And is that something you kept in mind when, because I know during your early years, I think when you were a teen, you started gradually losing your sight. So how did that impact your ability to study and to attend school and to just get that full experience and support?
For me, I wasn't terribly well supported in terms of orchestra, particularly in terms of classical music in general. I would say that the subject matter is very, very traditional. It can be a bit stuffy, a bit less inclusive, and these things can affect you when you're trying to move forward. I found particularly I was actually treated worse in the sciences by science teachers and those who cultivated the sciences, as opposed to music. I think music has become much more inclusive than it used to be, but there are certain things that are expected when someone is visually impaired. They expect that you won't be able to function in an orchestra. They assume you won't be able to learn the music. They assume that you won't be very adaptable. And if you have remaining vision that you can use to look at the conductor and you can memorize your music, there's actually no reason that you can't be in an orchestra. But sometimes people don't understand. And sometimes, if you pick your battles right, sometimes it's right to go and actually explain to people what you're capable of.
What impact did having all sorts of, I guess, negative stereotypical expectations on you, what impact did that have on how you're feeling and your confidence?
When you are in those formative years, what adults say matters greatly and can affect the direction that you go in. And as you get older, that happens less and less. But I do also believe that it was quite useful for me to practice putting forward what I'm capable of and explaining that to people and laying out my needs, my boundaries, and practicing with those things. You can find yourself in this position of saying, oh dear, I don't really know what I'm doing, and this teacher has told me, or this conductor has told me, that this is where it ends. But for everything else I had done in music, where originally I couldn't do something and then I would work very hard and then eventually be able to do it, the same was true for my sight loss. So if I needed to relearn something, for me, it was the same process, just one my conductor had not gone through and therefore perhaps might assume I couldn't do. My main orchestra conductor was very supportive, and some are, and that can be just enough to keep you going. I don't think it actually takes that much encouragement for a child to try hard. I do, however, feel that so many children with disabilities don't even get that. And it's easier to tell somebody they're not going to make it than to go through the journey with them. There's unfortunately not a lot you can do about that if a person feels that way, but you still have to have your own self-agency about you, and you've got to decide, am I going to pick this battle and fight it? Or is there something else more important to me right now? And ascertain what you prioritize and what you're willing to fight for. Because if you are willing to fight for something like playing in an orchestra or becoming a scientist or whatever it might be, then you are going to have to make a very conscious decision to do that regardless of what you've been told.
Well, that actually brings me up to current days. You're in your early 20s and you're now actually performing with a symphony orchestra. How was that process? Is that one of those instances where you really had to put your foot down and be like, give me a chance, I can show you how good I am?
I was very lucky with the symphony orchestra that they were so inclusive and regularly asked me if everything was accessible. When it comes to concerts, sometimes I find that's where things and venues can be slightly inaccessible. But I wanted to actually move over to a philharmonic orchestra. So I really love the pieces that one might play in a philharmonic orchestra. But the philharmonic orchestra, however, suggested that it was highly unlikely that I could play the violin because somebody in my position shouldn't be able to. And they sent me a series of emails saying that they wouldn't make the auditions accessible. They weren't really 100% convinced that I could play the violin, and they weren't entirely sure if I was going to, quote unquote, ruin the fun of adaptability. So there are orchestras there that will not accept you and can be very difficult. My own opinion is you've got to decide whether perhaps that's an orchestra of people that perhaps you're not going to get on with anyway. So should you battle it out or should you find a better orchestra? It's a complicated process because some of it is prejudice and some of it is that some people are extremely stuffy and difficult and perhaps you may not enjoy playing alongside them anyway. So pick your battles. If you think that someone's just misunderstanding you, go for it. If you think somebody has perhaps not a good attitude, then maybe you don't want them training you anyway.
So is that why you perhaps, you took a bit of a swivel onto online by sharing your music there? I think you sing, you incorporate different languages into it.
Well, I actually conducted a challenge where people would request a language for me to sing in, and I would sing in that language. I have a classical singing history, so you do learn how to sing in other languages. I sung in 25 languages in total and was in the media in 8 countries for my singing. This was really interesting, a far more inclusive space, and you could connect with other people's heritages. I could connect with my own heritage. You could meet people all around the world. But interestingly, when I visited venues that my friends are performing at or where I'm joining to perform, the venues are also equally sometimes a little bit inaccessible. And because the industry itself is slightly less regulated, it's very complicated for you to fit in where you're going and when you're going and who you're meeting or networking with. And that has its own challenges. So I would say you've got to decide really with music which one you prefer most. If you prefer both like me, then you could dabble in both easily. But they have their different challenges. One is more structured, disciplined, is really great when you're young for building that fantastic foundation of music. And the other is more sort of popular music. You're going to meet lots of people, but it might be less regulated and there may be less structure for you to rely on.
Now, what I would like to talk about as well, whilst we have you on the show today, is something that you're maybe planning for the future, because you sound extremely ambitious. So I would like to know what your next goal or maybe perhaps your biggest dream at the moment is.
It's a really interesting question, because at the moment my time is taken up writing a book. So I'm currently writing a parallel to Charles Babbage's Reflections on the Decline of Science in England and on some of its causes. And my modern parallel is entitled Reflections on the Decline of Belief in Science. And it talks about my generation, my observations of my generation, and talks about statistics and research referring to how we've developed in the tech era, how we acquire information, what causes us to distrust certain sources that used to be immediately trusted. And I talk about the pros and cons of the impacts of that. I also go into family structures and how they've changed. This is really a book that I've planned for many years, just really watching as my generation has grown up, seeing who we've become and what matters to us. And I wanted to sort of pen it so that it would encourage more research and encourage people to take quite seriously some of the impacts that social media and the internet might have on my generation.
It is lovely hearing about everything you are doing at the moment. So what would be the best way to keep up with your music and perhaps your book as well?
If people would like to keep up on Instagram, that would be ideal. And actually, if people want to follow my private personal account, then I'm sort of more accessible to talk about sight loss or to receive messages. So that would be at d.a.babbage. If you want to connect with me there and hear about my book, then it's a smaller space where I can actually connect with people properly.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, Deborah, just one final question. What short piece of advice you would give to someone who is perhaps going through sight loss but considering a career in music?
I would say it's a wonderful thing, and by experiencing sight loss, perhaps you can connect to the music in ways that other people can't, through your ears, through feeling sound and emotion in a far depthier way. But remember that not everybody has had an experience that is similar to sight loss, and therefore their advice doesn't need to be taken too seriously if you think it's going to stop you. The best thing also to do is to connect with as many musicians as you can, because there are certain musicians who have far more creativity and understanding than others. So if one conductor tells you you can't do something, look for another person. And also trust your own ability to overcome problems and to see the end result. You don't always need other people to tell you that you can do something in order for you to go about that and get it done.
Well, Deborah, thank you so much for sharing that wonderful piece of advice and for talking to us about your passion for music on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
the one and only Bill Haley in the comments with Rock Around the Clock, or We're Gonna Rock Around the Clock. You're listening to The Happy Hour with Paulina, and we like talking on the show a lot about different ways of looking after our mental health and our well-being. Well, today we are going to listen to a very important conversation as Amelia speaks with Kat, who will share her experience of sight loss and recovery from an eating disorder.
Eating disorders can impact anyone, including blind and partially sighted people. We're joined today by Kat Nichols, who's going to share her personal experiences of an eating disorder and vision loss. And we're also talking to clinical advice coordinator Umaira Malik to learn about support. They're both part of the charity BEAT, which raises awareness and provides support for people impacted by eating disorders. So, Kat, when were you first able to acknowledge you had an eating disorder?
When I started therapy. So I was struggling. I was around 14 or 15 and my parents saw that I was struggling and they kind of dragged me to the doctors lovingly. And the doctor recommended I get counselling. So they referred me on to that. And it wasn't until I had the first couple of sessions with a counsellor that I decided to tell them about my eating thing, which I called it then. That's when they said to me, I think you're struggling with an eating disorder. I wasn't really sure if I believed them, but then they referred me on to specialist support. And the more I kind of learned about it, the more I realised that that is what was happening to me. It's really hard to realise what it is when you're in it. It's very easy to be in denial. And also back then, there wasn't so much awareness about eating disorders. But yeah, after a lot of work with some therapists, I acknowledged that that was what was happening to me and decided that I did want to move on from it and recover.
After having some time now to reflect, do you have ideas about how it started to develop?
Looking back, I realised that anxiety was something I struggled with from a young age. But back then, it wasn't really spoken about or known about. So I was having things like chest pain and headaches. Nobody really knew what it was. They just thought I was a headachy child, or the chest pain was to do with just growing up and growing pains. But then the older I've gotten, the more I've understood more about mental health, I realized that that was actually anxiety and I was struggling with that. And I think that definitely fed into developing an eating disorder and making that a go-to option for my brain and my mind. And I remember struggling with this feeling of belonging. And even though I did have a good group of friends around me at the time, I didn't feel like I belonged, like I was part of their friendship group, that I was wanted, that I was liked. And I kind of needed something to pin that on. And for whatever reason, I decided to pin it on my body. And I kind of thought if I could change it, if I could be smaller, then everything else in my life would be better and would change. Eating disorder was really about having a sense of control. This isn't the same for everyone. Everyone is different. But for me, everything in my life had kind of felt like it was spiraling out of control and I wanted something that I could control. And that's when I realized I could make a difference to my size. And that just became somewhat of a coping mechanism.
And do you think experiencing vision loss and being in and out of hospitals impacted or interacted with your eating disorder?
So when I had the eye injury, so I wore contact lenses in water and developed an infection and was hospitalised and lost some sight in my left eye permanently. I had recently relapsed in my eating disorder, but I had pulled myself through that relapse and I'd kind of said to myself, I'm never going back there again. So when this all happened, it was an interesting point because I felt a little bit like I was losing control again of my body. Found out I'd lost my sight. I was having to stay in hospital. I was being woken up every hour to have eye drops and things like that. So it could have been a very triggering moment for me to go back to that coping mechanism of eating disorder behavior. But instead, because of where I was in my recovery and because I had just pulled myself through a relapse, I was in a good enough place to not go back to those coping mechanisms. And I had a really good support system around me. I found other ways of coping with this sense of loss of control and managed to move past it.
Has the recovery process been non-linear like that for you a lot of the time?
Yes, I think anyone who has been through recovery will probably say it's non-linear. And I did mention I had a relapse and I think that's not uncommon. I think a lot of people who go through recovery do experience relapses from time to time. I was quite lucky I only really experienced it once during university, which again is quite common because you dictate what you eat and where you eat and how you eat. So it can be quite easy to fall back into those habits. And like I said, it is like a coping mechanism. So when you're experiencing difficult emotions, it can be a go-to behavior to lean on those eating disorder behaviors. So I think a huge part of recovery for me was really rebuilding my sense of self-worth and my identity away from having an eating disorder and building that up from scratch. And I think that's why I have been able to stay in recovery for so long, because I have been able to do that. But having said that, I'm now 15 years into recovery, and there are still things that I struggle with. For example, if there are calories on menus, that is tough to see. So even after all of that time, there is definitely still work to be done, but it is so much easier than it was at the start. And even though it is kind of an ongoing process, it just does get so much better, and it's so worth the work.
And what do you think is a common misconception?
It's easy to think that eating disorders are very simple, and they're very much about just wanting to lose weight or just wanting to change weight and change a size. But the truth is, they are such complex things. They have multiple and nuanced causes going on behind them. I mentioned that for me, control was a big part of it, but for other people, that has nothing to do with it. And I think it's easy to kind of pigeonhole people thinking they do certain things and they are a certain way because of a certain reason. But the truth is, they are just as complex as the individual that has them. And yeah, they are very nuanced and they need a lot more attention, I think.
And what's something you would have liked to know, or support you would have liked to have been given when you needed support?
I would really have loved to have been told that I am valued as I am, and for me to be able to believe that. And also that I mentioned earlier that recovery is worth the work. And that is something I want to tell everyone who is struggling at the moment, because recovery is really hard. It's so much easier to give in to the eating disorder behaviors and do what it's telling you to do because it feels safe, it feels comfortable, it feels known. And through recovery, you really have to challenge that. You have to challenge these behaviors and what this condition wants you to do. And it's difficult, but it is so, so worth the work. Now that I'm out the other side of it, life is just 100% different. It is freedom. It is being able to do what I want when I want. And it is so worth the work.
So Umaira, do you mind telling us what we mean by the term eating disorder and what different conditions come under that umbrella?
So eating disorders are, we know, are complex mental illnesses. They impact around 1.25 million people in the UK. The actual statistic might be higher than that, but we know they affect people of all ages, all genders and all backgrounds. And so there are a variety of different types of eating disorders. Sometimes people might move between diagnoses if their symptoms change. And the main thing we always highlight is that regardless of which eating disorder anyone might have, they deserve the right support and treatment for it. And we know recovery is possible. Some of the more commonly known eating disorders are, for example, anorexia, which is where someone might limit how much they eat and drink. They might restrict their intake and they might experience a fear of weight gain. There's also an eating disorder called bulimia, which involves cycles of binge eating and restriction and purging. That might be by taking laxatives, overexercising or vomiting. And so another eating disorder is also binge eating disorder. We estimate that 1 in 50 people in the UK will experience this in their lifetime. And so it usually involves eating large quantities of food where someone might not feel in control of what they're doing, and it can be a really distressing experience. Now, someone might not fit into the symptoms of the three eating disorders I've just described, and so they might receive a diagnosis of something called OSFED, which stands for Otherwise Specified Food Intake Disorder. And it's actually the most common eating disorder. And so there's often this misconception that someone with an eating disorder needs to be underweight, which we know isn't true. There's also an eating disorder called ARFID, which stands for Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. And now, this isn't characterised by a fear of weight gain. It's when a person might restrict or avoid certain foods because they've experienced distress or had a stressful experience with food in the past, for example, choking. And so they might also struggle with the texture of food and have sensory challenges around food.
How common are eating disorders in the UK?
So we know that the pandemic has had a huge impact on people with eating disorders. Lots of people have experienced higher levels of stress, isolation, anxiety. So although we predict that around 1.25 million people in the UK might be affected, the actual statistic might be a lot higher than that, and demand for treatment is continuing to rise.
And anyone can be affected, and that includes people with sight loss or people who have been blind since birth.
Absolutely. Eating disorders aren't just about body image. They're complex mental illnesses. We know they impact all different kinds of people. And some people might experience negative body image as part of that. However, there are many who don't. For example, someone with ARFID might experience sensory issues that are unrelated to their appearance. And there's also this misconception that eating disorders only impact people who are underweight. But we know they impact people of all weights, shapes and sizes. And, you know, that includes people who might be blind or visually impaired. To this day, there's an underrepresentation of minority groups in research. So further research is required to widen our understanding of the connection between eating disorders and disabilities. But we know that those groups are very much affected. You know, another misconception might be that they're white female illnesses, but anyone can develop an eating disorders. This year for Eating Disorders Awareness Week, we're focusing on men with eating disorders because it's assumed that a quarter of those with eating disorders are male. So often people don't realise they have an eating disorder because of these harmful stereotypes that exist. This can put them at serious risk. And so we know that the sooner an eating disorder is recognised, the sooner someone can access support, the better their chances are of making a full recovery.
And what support is available for people concerned that they themselves or someone they know might have an eating disorder?
So if someone is listening and they're worried about themselves or a loved one, we'd recommend reaching out to their GP as the first part of call, asking for an urgent appointment. Sometimes it can help to book a double appointment. Sometimes people find it helpful to plan for this appointment. They might want to list the difficulties that they're having with their eating or the difficulties that they've realised or recognised in their loved one. We've got a really great leaflet on our website that can help people prepare for the appointment, and it also addresses some misconceptions that they might experience if they do reach out to their GP and how to address those. In some areas, people can also contact their local eating disorder service to see whether they accept self-referrals. Now, if you're looking to just have a conversation or you're looking for some more support or information around eating disorders, we're also here 365 days a year. We've got a dedicated helpline team who can be contacted via the phone, via web chat or email, whichever feels more comfortable. That is for anyone who feels that they might have an eating disorder or that they're concerned for a loved one. We know that the impact on carers who are supporting someone with an eating disorder can be a really worrying and difficult time, and so we are here for anybody affected. Our website is beateatingdisorders.org.uk. We've got an accessibility tab at the top of the website for anyone who might struggle to navigate that. And in terms of resources, we run online support groups, which you can sign up for and access when they're running. There's no sort of waiting time for those online support groups. We run a number of programmes in different areas for anyone who might be supporting somebody with an eating disorder who might be affected themselves. In terms of resources, we have information on how you can navigate a conversation with a loved one, how to navigate, for example, someone's reluctance to accept that they might have an eating disorder. And we've also got some resources if you are going to the GP, or for example, we've got a specific one for people who feel that they might have binge eating disorder and are looking to access support through their GP or their local eating disorder service.
Well, thank you so much, Kat Nichols and Umaira Malik, for talking to us at RNIB Connect Radio.
No problem.
Thank you so much for having us.
You can call the Beat Helpline at 0808 801 0677 or go to beateatingdisorders.org.uk for the one-on-one web chat.
Thank you so much, Amelia. And still to come on the happy hour, we'll be chatting with VI skier Minna Fitzpatrick. She's Britain's most decorated winter Paralympian. Our Toby Davey will be catching up with her after a very important competition. I'll also give you some interesting data or an interesting story about teaching happiness in schools. I'll tell you a little bit more very shortly on the show. And you know what? Deborah will actually return as well to share her music therapy choice for this week. And you know what? It's a great one. Oh, I love that track. You're listening to The Happy Hour with Paulina, and it's time to take a look at a feel-good story from the last week, and I dug out a really good one. Apparently, elementary schools in a town in Germany, the town's called Braunschweig, is doing something lovely. They are teaching happiness to the kids. So alongside math and reading and other usual classes, the kids are learning how to be happy and how to look after their happiness. And the classes are apparently running once a week. So it sounds like such a lovely project. And some of the things I've seen them actually do include gratitude necklaces and gardens of emotions. Oh, so it all sounds lovely. And some of the things that kids have been actually writing up are, and I can read out a few for you, is I got to snuggle with my dog, which is a great one. I found a coin on the street, or my dad cuddled with me this morning. So lovely, lovely stories and lovely examples of gratitude, actually. I feel like we all should practice it on the daily. Out of Our Heads by Take That. What a really good tune, this one, actually. And it's, I think, one of their more recent tracks as well. You're listening to The Happy Hour with Paulina. Now it's time to get a bit sporty, and we're specifically going to be chatting about winter sports. With more on that, here's our Toby Davey.
Off to the slopes now here on RNIB Connect Radio to catch up with visually impaired Paralympic GB skier Menna Fitzpatrick, who has just recently come back from the 2023 Para Alpine World Championships out in Spain with her guide skier Katie Guest, with a silver in the giant slalom and a bronze in the slalom. Hello, Menna. Welcome back to RNIB Connect Radio, and congratulations to you and Katie on your medals out at the World Alpine Skiing Championships, and a couple more to your medal tally too, I suspect.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was an amazing event, and I was so happy to ski in Spain. Not often we get that chance, but yeah, it was an amazing event for sure.
And what were the sort of conditions out there in Spain for the Para Alpine Worlds? And what was the sort of competition like for you and Katie?
The conditions started off with maybe a couple of weeks before thinking that it was going to be cancelled because of the lack of snow. But actually, the week before, we had about a metre of snow, and it didn't stop snowing for about 3 or 4 days. So it ended up being a bit too much snow to actually be able to race for the first couple of days, at least. And then we actually didn't get a chance to race our downhill or the usual schedule because it was really, really windy. It was about maybe 100 kilometre an hour winds at the top of a slope. So that's not really ideal for standing there in a tight catsuit at the top of the hill getting ready to race. So yeah, so it didn't actually start off particularly well for everybody. But then we finally, the wind died down and we managed to get some races in. And we were super, super happy with how we skied in the Super G, and especially the Super Combined. My actually skiing was really, really good. But unfortunately, I straddled a gate in the slalom, which is the second run of the Super Combined race. And unfortunately, that means that we didn't finish, basically. So our result didn't count, which was absolutely gutting for the both of us. So to go back out there and ski the giant slalom as well as we did, and to win that silver and then the bronze on the slalom day, was absolutely amazing, because I actually didn't feel very well on the slalom day either. So I've had a bit of a cough and a cold and everything like that. So trying to do a slalom race was very tiring for sure. And so I'm super, super proud of how we raced and skied at the World Championships.
And when you and Katie are out there, do you sort of keep an eye on the competition, your rivals, and any sort of new visually impaired skiers that are coming through? Do you keep a close eye on what they're doing, how they're doing?
Well, we always watch each other race. We, once we've finished, Katie will basically describe whether they're doing well or not, and the times on the screen, so I could get a picture of how well our competitors are doing. As para athletes, we want everyone to do well, and we want to make sure that everyone gets down the hill safely as well. So we're always happy to see the races finish for sure from every nation, but we see what each other do on social media. We'll see what they're like in the training days or in the warm-up courses that we do, and then at the end of the day, it's whoever skis the fastest in the race that wins. So it's really nice because you can't tell who's going to win, because we're all so tightly competitive, and it's really progressing the sport as well. So it's really cool.
And I think from talking to you at the Winter Paralympics in Beijing, Menno, I think you have a little bit of sight to be able to see your guide in front of you, and especially if they're wearing sort of quite sort of bright jackets and stuff and things like that. But how, I suppose, how easy or difficult it might it be sort of not to sort of get too close to them and stuff and things like that? Because I think you can sort of lose or maybe gain penalties if you're too close to your guide skier.
Yeah, so the rule is that if you touch skis, you are completely disqualified and out of the race. And if you go too far, so more than 3 gates, you can also get disqualified as well. So there's that short window, basically, that you need to be in before you get disqualified. And so that's a team goal, basically, that I, as soon as I feel uncomfortable with how far away I am from Katie, because I can see a bright orange blob, basically. So if that blob gets smaller and smaller, then I can tell that I'm too far away from her. And if it gets too big, then I'll basically tell her to go and hurry up. But also, if I'm not quite so sure, I'll say through the comms with the microphone and headsets, I will say a distance check to Katie, and then she could have a quick look behind. Then she can judge how much to slow down or to speed up, depending on what she sees.
I suppose that might sort of be reflective on sort of what you can see on the day kind of thing, because I suppose different conditions can make your eyes see either a bit more or a bit less kind of thing.
Yeah, so for me, this track was actually quite difficult, especially from the light, because you would start off with the sun shining on the snow and it's really quite bright and everything's quite amplified, and then we would go on to the steeper part of the slope and it would be completely in the shadow and in the shade, and so you've gone from really bright to fairly dark in the matter of seconds. So for me, that's really hard, and if it then goes from shadow to bright, I'm essentially completely blind for that whole section. I can't see Katie, I can't necessarily see the gates. I've just got to rely on my memory and Katie's comms through the headsets for that bit, and so we've got to make sure that the communication is right on point from the moment we go, really.
The next Winter Paralympics Games is, I think, about 3 years away, and actually in Milan in Italy, which sounds fantastic. Do you and Katie already have your sights on the next Winter Paralympic Games?
Yeah, it's definitely a team goal, for sure, because unfortunately Katie didn't get to go to Beijing because she got COVID. So she was meant to be my primary guide for that. But instead, I had to use Gary, who was our reserve guide and has been my guide before as well. So I'm really lucky that he was there. But now Katie's back as my primary guide, and hopefully nothing will stop us actually getting to Italy. And I'm sort of classing it as a home games, because it's as close as we're going to get to a home games as well. So I'm really excited for that.
And finally, Menno, if someone listening now has been maybe inspired to get into skiing as a visually impaired person, what advice would you give them, and where would you sort of point them to go to maybe find out a little bit more about skiing as a blind or partially sighted person?
That is a very good question. If you are inspired or really want to get into skiing, there is plenty of snow domes, dry ski slopes that will happily try and accommodate your needs and help you learn how to ski. So if you're in the UK, that will be a charity called Disability Snow Sports UK. They have plenty of instructors around the UK that will certainly set you up with a ski lesson somewhere. And also if you're in Wales, there's a great club and charity called Disability Skiing Wales, and they're a great bunch of people who have ski sessions for every sort of disability. So give it a go, and I hope you get hooked in like I did.
Well, fantastic, and thank you very much indeed, Menno, for joining me here on RNIB Connect Radio and telling me more about your great success at the 2023 Para Alpine Championships in Spain.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much, Toby Davy there. Now, coming up on the happy hour, we are slowly nearing the end, but don't worry, music therapy moment is going to be here shortly. It makes you feel good. And that is us at the end of today's happy hour. Thank you so much for keeping me company. I had a lovely time, as always. Remember, if you would like to listen back to any of these lovely interviews we had on the show today, you can always get a hold of our podcast. Just search for RNIB Happy Hour Podcast online and you'll be able to find all of those episodes there, all of those interviews. You can share them with someone you think might really enjoy it as well. Now, we have time for one last thing, as always. It's our music therapy moment, in which we bring a guest to introduce a final track for the show, and it needs to be something that carries a lot of meaning for them, hence the music therapy moment name. And today's track was actually chosen by Deborah, so we'll let her play us out, and I'll see you on next week's episode. Bye!
Hi, it's Deborah again, and my song choice today is Nakupenda by a lovely Nigerian lady called Yemi Alade. I hope that you will enjoy hearing something international today, and I hope it broadens your ears.
You are listening to the Happy Hour podcast, a trimmed down version of our hour long show. If you've enjoyed the songs and would like to hear them in full, along with all the interviews, tips and chat, just catch the full show on RNIB Connect Radio. We're on every Monday at 1 p.m. with a repeat Thursday at 6 p.m. and Sunday at 10 a.m.
For more downloads like these, visit rnibconnectradio.org.uk/podcasts.